Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us virtually for our coffee and donuts meeting. Hopefully everybody has their coffee in front of them. I actually, skipping the donuts, try not to gain the weight during our lockdown, but hopefully other people have more time to exercise and can enjoy some donuts as well. So I want to thank everybody for joining us this morning, and I know a lot of people had RSVP'd for our original meeting topic, which was about non-disclosure agreements. With the implementation of the America's Care Act, we thought that it would be best to pivot this last week and to give everybody as much information as we knew this morning about the SBA loans that come under the America's Care Act. And we actually know a lot more than we might have expected to, because the SBA came out last night with interim final rules about how some of those loans will be administered. So with me today, I have two of my colleagues, Danielle Assad and Joe Yannotti. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Leah Brownlee. I'm of counsel in the corporate group at Squire Patton Boggs. I spend, most of my working life working on the company side, with early to mid-stage companies, a lot of venture-backed companies, and really have spent most of my career working in that area, over the last 15 years. And so this, topic is of particular interest to me because it affects just about 100% of the clients that I work with day in and day out. So I'll ask Danielle if she can give you some of her background as well, and then Joe.
Yeah, thanks, Leah. This is Danielle Slack. Good morning, everybody. I'm a partner in the corporate group at Squire. I mainly, in the past, have done deal work with private equity firms and investors. The reason I'm on today is to help explain certain rules that are applicable if you want to get a specific type of loan under the Small Business Act. So hopefully we'll be able to answer as many questions as we can. This is new legislation, and there's no precedent, so we'll do what we can and answer as much as we can. If you have follow-up questions, obviously you can reach out to us afterwards, and then we'll try to help you as much as we can. Hope all of you are doing well. We'll get through this hopefully, and we hope this presentation helps a little bit. Joe.
Thank you, Danielle. Thank you, Leah. Appreciate it. My name is Joe Yannotti. I'm a partner in the tax and benefits group here at Squire. And on this beautiful Friday morning, I deal with all things retirement plans, executive comp, and health and welfare, also mergers and acquisitions. And now, CARES Act. For the last week, the pace at which the legislation has been signed, digesting everything that is benefits related to the SBA loan provisions and other provisions that affect all of our clients across the country. And in addition, I'm here to try to bridge some of the provisions that are found in the benefits provisions of the CARES Act to the SBA loan provision. So feel free to ask us questions throughout this presentation, and we will be happy to attempt to answer your questions. So thank you for joining us this morning. Leah?
Oh, thanks a lot, Joe. I just want to echo that sentiment. As you have questions, please go ahead and put it in the Q&A panel. If we can get to them while we're in the discussion, we will get to them. If not, we have a reserve some time at the end to answer questions as well. As Joe said, over the last week, we've been figuring this out. So, this is a brand new law, and we've all been reading it, and we've been watching, what's been going on in D.C. as the law is enacted, and we're figuring out how it's going to go into effect. So we know as much as we can at this time. And we also know that the SBA and the Treasury are still implementing regulations. So we'll continue to learn more, and we continue to send us questions. We'll answer them to the best of our ability. So whether or not it's today or, you know, over the weekend in the future, if you have questions, please send them in, and we'll do what we can to answer them. Then I just want to say a quick thank you. We don't do this alone. Today you're just hearing from Squire attorneys, but we have a number of co-sponsors that help promote this event. And I see a number of them on the line today that are learning with us, and really have been keeping up with us as this new law and as this kind of new and hopefully temporary normal, is rolling out for all of us. And then, you know, just a quick note, we'll send out this presentation afterward, but we want to give you as a resource, and these are live links where you see it in yellow here, we have some COVID-19 resources that are not specific to CARES Act, but they address really what's happening around the world, and locally, on any number of different industries, any number of different issues. And we have a resource hub that helps to sort through that. So if you're facing a specific issue, and you want to know if we have any information, whether it be in Europe, in the U.S., in insurance, SBA loans, whatever it is, we may have written something on it. We have a fairly well-filled resource hub. And if you can't find something, again, lob a question over. We do have a lot of expertise in this, and we have a broad reach across the U.S. and across the world for people who have very subject matter-specific expertise. And then the second one is we have a contingency planning tool. I would encourage anybody with a business to spend the 15 minutes with this tool, because what you'll get out of answering all the questions is actually a report back telling you how your contingency planning is doing and areas where you can improve. So it's well worth the time, especially if you have a business, if you're reporting to a board of directors, it really tells you where you should be mapping and where you should be moving your business at this time. So with that, I guess launch into what's going on and what the subject of this webinar is. So the America's CARES Act. This is legislation that we're talking about today, in particular two programs under this legislation. And this was adopted into law very, very quickly. So if we look at the timeline, on March 13th, the president declared an emergency for the entire U.S. By March 27th, the Senate, the House, and the president had signed a new bill that funded, $2 trillion of stimulus funding into the U.S., and of that $2 trillion, more than $360 billion of it is targeted towards small businesses and helping them keep their employees in place and keep their businesses afloat during this downturn where a lot of us are working from home. A lot of businesses may be unable to do the business that they normally would do because of the emergency legislation, both at the federal and the state and local level. And things have really changed. So this federal government is trying, and they're working really hard. The first program, and this has been all over the news, is the Paycheck Protection Program. And it'll be the first one that we talk about today. So this is a brand new program. And as you may have heard, it can give you, up to 2.5 months of salary for your business. Back to your business as a forgivable loan. The second program is the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program. Now, this program has existed in the past. The federal government uses it in disaster scenarios, so think Hurricane Katrina or, any of the number of other disasters that have happened in the recent past. there are specific provisions that are new for this current COVID-19 time under this program. But because it was an existing program, it also had an existing structure for how it was managed. And the government is utilizing that structure to manage the disaster loans today. So I guess I'll launch into the Paycheck Protection Program. Question one is loan eligibility. So how do you know you're eligible? And I think there's a really good feeling around among anybody who works at a smaller business that they are eligible. So we look at 500 or fewer employees in the business. So a lot of businesses are encapsulated in this. There are, you know, a few businesses outside of this realm. So if there's SBA employee-based size standards for your industry that are based on NAICS codes, if by chance you have more than 500 employees, you might still qualify based on your NAICS code, based on a dollar threshold or a different threshold that's in the current regulations. And you have to be a small business concern. So that's generally going to apply to almost everybody. Or you can be a 501c3, so a nonprofit, a veteran organization, tribal business, et cetera. One thing to watch out for, and Danielle's going to talk about in a minute, is what's known as the affiliation rules. So we have to see, based on who owns your business, who can control your business, and whether or not you need to count more than just your employees to determine if you're eligible. And then, I guess most importantly, you have to have been in business on February 15th and had employees that you paid wages to or independent contractors. And this is because you need to provide you have to provide evidence of paying people to be eligible for the loan. So I'll turn it over to Danielle and let her talk about that affiliation rules item that I said you have to be really careful and look at.
Thank you, Leah. Yeah, if you've been following the news about the PPP program, you probably picked up on an issue of the application of existing affiliation rules. I hope everybody can hear me. So the concept here is the Small Business Administration looks at affiliation and looks to see when one business controls or has the power to control another business, or if a third party controls or has the power to control two or more businesses. So control is very important in this analysis. I thought instead of I thought I'd walk you through some examples so that you can see how the Small Business Administration looks at this. Unfortunately, the rules are very broad and in favor of the Small Business Administration, and the Small Business Administration looks at the totality of circumstances. So it's kind of hard to get away from these rules, so it's important to know what they are, and so I thought I'd walk you through some examples. The first category is stock ownership. If a person owns 50% or more of the voting stock, then they're automatically deemed to be an affiliate of the company. What if someone owns less than 50% of the stock, but still a significant amount? So in the first example, Company A owns 40% of the voting stock of Company B. The next largest shareholder only has about 2% of the voting stock. In this case, the SBA says that Company A controls Company B because it owns the largest lot of voting stock compared to everyone else. And therefore, Company A and Company B are affiliates. And what that means is if company A is trying to figure out if it's eligible as a small business, if it's eligible to get a loan, it has to count company A's employees and company B's employees to figure out whether it meets the 500 employee threshold. Second example, investor X, investor Y, and company A each own 23% of company B. No other stockholder owns more than 5% of company B. Here, all three persons will be presumed to control company B by the Small Business Administration, unless each of them can rebut this presumption, by presenting evidence to the SBA showing that they don't control. Unless they can do that, they're all deemed affiliates of company B. So that's the first category. The second category is stock options, convertible securities, and agreements to merge. Example three is if company A holds an option to purchase a controlling interest in company B. It has not exercised it. It just has the option to buy a controlling interest. Here the SBA says that company A and company B are affiliates because the SBA assumes that company A exercised its right under these options. It doesn't matter if it has or hasn't. What matters is the fact that it exists for the SBA.
Danielle, just a quick question on this one. So I see convertible securities, which makes me think of preferred stock. Do we have any notes from the SBA about maybe a venture-backed ownership position where it would be preferred stock convertible into common, or any guidance on that area?
So we would need to look at the actual instrument, the actual preferred stock instrument, and if the venture capital firm can exercise this preferred stock and turn it into a significant amount of voting stock. If that right exists, then there could be a possibility that it is affiliated with the company.
Danielle, we have a question. Are there any special provisions or caveats if the affiliate is a nonprofit?
There are guidelines when it comes to nonprofits. We can provide information on that. I had just based my examples on corporations that are profitable or that are not structured as nonprofits.
So we'll circle back with maybe reach out to the individual that asked that question and provide an answer.
Yeah, we'll try to do that. The next category of affiliation rules is the common management. Example four here says members of Company A's board of directors occupy 3 out of 5 board seats in Company B's board of directors. Here, the company A has control of company B, and the two are considered affiliates by the SBA. And the reason is if one or more officers, directors, managing members, or general partners of a business controls the board of directors or the management of another business, those businesses are considered affiliates by the SBA. Example five, a member of Company A's board of directors has veto rights over the majority decisions of Company B's board of directors. Here, the SBA will look at these veto rights, even if they are what we call negative control rights. Here, the company A would be deemed to control the board of directors of company B, and these two, the company A and company B, would be considered affiliates. There is guidance that we can provide later on what types of decisions or veto rights are allowed and would not be considered controlling rights by the SBA. So here, the SBA does not consider the right to approve an amendment of a company's articles of incorporation or bylaws, or issuing additional shares of stock, or adding or bringing on new members. Fundamental changes like these, the SBA will not consider to be controlled. But if a shareholder or its board of direct or its member on the board has the right to approve amending a lease agreement, for example, or issuing dividends, changing compensation, officer compensation, approving the budget, incurring debts. It's these things that the SBA looks at and says, this is, you're controlling this business, and therefore you're an affiliate.
Right. And I want to flag the last three that Danielle said, because the dividends, the change of pay to C-level executives, the incurrence of debt, those are standard provisions that we put into venture financing. And so there's a lot of concern right now about a lot of venture finance companies possibly not qualifying. And there's a lot of, you know, political pressure on this point as well. So we may be seeing, or we would expect to see, more guidance on these points from the SBA in the very near term. But we haven't seen it yet.
Yes, thank you, Leah. The fourth category of affiliation rules is identity of the interest between individuals or businesses. Individuals that have identical or really substantial identical businesses or interests could be treated as affiliates unless they can show that they're not. So example six, here several officers of company A are also officers of company B. The two companies are in the same line of work and extensively subcontract with each other. The SBA says that the interrelationship between these two companies results in them acting as one, and therefore the two are considered affiliates unless the owners can show that, no, they're two separate companies, but it'll be hard to do if they're in the same line of business and subcontract with each other. Example seven, company A and company B share office space and equipment in the same location, and also share key employees, like office manager, for example. And here, company A has also sent a substantial amount of business to company B in the past 3 years. The SBA says, look, taking all these facts together, there's an indication that these two companies have combined their resources to each other's benefit, and therefore they are affiliated unless they can show otherwise. The last category of affiliation rules that's relevant here is contractual relationships or economic dependency. So here, if a company is cannot survive on its own or is economically dependent on another company or person, then the SBA says this dependency means really control. So here's example eight. Company A performs subcontracts for Company B, and Company B accounts for 90% of Company A's revenues. So here the FDA says Company A's existence really depends on work from Company B, and therefore they're deemed to be affiliates. And then finally, the last example, Company A provides significant loans to Company B and guarantees other loans to Company B. Here, Company B's other reliance of over-reliance of dependence on Company A for financial support means that they are affiliates. So as you can see from these examples, the SBA takes a broad approach to figuring out affiliation, and you really need to analyze the companies that you regularly do business with or who provide a lot of your business or revenues, figure out if your officers are or directors are in other directors of other companies or officers, and if you're doing relationships with that company. So it's an analysis that you've got to go through. There's no, you know, one easy rule to just follow, but like I said, they're pretty broad, and the idea is the SBA or the Small Business Act is there for small businesses. It's not there for companies that have lots of subsidiaries or affiliates. It's there for small businesses, and for, you know, whatever reason, the stimulus package was written under the Small Business Act, and so we have to live with these affiliation rules. But the your next slide, the CARES Act has a waiver of these rules for three categories of businesses. So this is these are businesses that may be on their own or have less than 500 employees, but when you look at all of their affiliates, then they're over the 500 threshold. What the CARES Act says is for these three categories, the rules are not going to apply. So as long as these three categories have less than 500 employees, then they could be eligible under this program. The first is those with NAICS codes beginning with 72. These are hotels, restaurants, caterers, travel accommodation providers. So it's really the food industry and the hotel industry. And another caveat here is if a company has multiple locations, and each location has less than 500, then it could be eligible to apply for loans for each of those locations. So it's a pretty broad waiver for the food and hotel industry, food service and hotel industry. The second category is for franchisees. Here it's got to be a franchise that has a franchise identifier code. And then finally, any business or company that already receives financial assistance from a company that's licensed under the Small Business Investment Act, so it's an SBIC. There also, there are affiliation rules that you have to comply with, so it's not a clear category, in my opinion. I've been trying to figure out what this category really, who it really picks up. But this is a third category. Hopefully we'll get more guidance on this because, the guidance provided really doesn't tell us all that much on who can access this. But as Leah mentioned, there is a lot of people lobbying and trying to explain to Congress that by having these existing affiliation rules apply to small businesses, except for these three categories where it's waived, a lot of small businesses may not be able to access loans under this program. And if they can't, then they may have to lay off people. And so it sort of goes against the intent of this program.
Right. Before we leave this affiliation rules, we do have a question that's really acutely to this point. So I want to go ahead and address it. And the question is because we don't have additional guidance from the SBA yet, should companies that don't meet the affiliate rule wait and submit later? And I guess there's a couple points to this. Is what you should do today is do your affiliate test. And if you determine based on your affiliate test that you do not meet the SBA requirements for this program, what you should not submit, because there are consequences for fraud under the program. If the reason you do not qualify is because one of those control provisions in an agreement, there is a potential way around it and qualify, which is by revising the agreement and getting rid of the control provision. So your investors may be willing to do that. They, of course, may want to see what SBA says first. But that's really the only category within the category of affiliates where you can contractually change something and pull yourself out of the affiliation rules. Thank you. And I think this is, it's a kind of gotcha a little bit within the rules, because I think on first glance, a lot of companies, fall into the Paycheck Protection Program, but you have to dig in deeper and you have to make sure that you do. And whether or not you do matters quite a bit based on how controlling your investors are or your board members and how you run your business. So let's say we get all the way to this point and you qualify, which I would think that most people are going to get to this point. If you qualify, how much can you get? We know that the maximum amount that can be issued under this program is $10 million. Not everybody can get $10 million, or should they? So there is a calculation for how much you can borrow under the program. And that calculation is 2.5 times the average monthly payroll cost incurred during the year prior to the loan date. And so when I say the year prior to the loan date, I mean when you go and apply today, if you go and apply today because the loans are open as of this morning, you would look at the last immediately prior 12-month period. So April 1, 2019 to March 31, 2020 is probably the period you're looking at for what your payroll is and how to do the calculation. So you take your payroll cost over that 12-month period and you average it. And what that payroll cost is actually a defined term by the SBA. And it includes, salary, wages, commissions to employees. So whether those employees are W-2 employees or if they receive 1099 miscellaneous forms. So it's not every independent contractor. It's the ones that would have been employees, but they weren't. They were independent contractors, and you issued a 1099 to them because they were individual consultants, not bigger companies that can also qualify. Leave pay. So they took sick pay, parental leave, vacation pay, that all counts. Healthcare benefit costs paid by the company, that all counts. Retirement benefits. So your company matches their 401k or just gives them a certain percentage of their salary into a retirement benefit. That counts. State and local tax paid by the employer, that counts. And then what if you pay separation pay or other pay in accordance with terminating an employee? That counts as well. So you take that, and that's for employers. But note, not just regular businesses can apply. Also, so can sole proprietorships, independent contractors, and self-employed people. And so there's a different formula for them because their business is structured differently. And I put it in there in the slide. So the sum of payments to or income of the sole proprietorship, that is not more than $100,000 in a year. So you take that sum and calculate it, and then you move on to excluded payroll costs, and you deduct those from your first calculation. And so I'll let Joe cover some of those excluded costs.
Yeah, and so the excluded costs are any compensation for an employee that is above $100,000, and that should be prorated for the period between February 15th and June 30th, 2020. In addition to it, its compensation to employees who live outside of the United States should be excluded as well, and that means anyone who has a principal place of residence that is outside the United States. Third, any payroll taxes and income taxes withheld between February 15th and June 30th, 2020. And finally, Leah mentioned that leave can be included. However, if an individual received qualified emergency paid sick leave or qualified extended family and medical emergency leave under the Family First Act, that should be excluded. So just a recap of the exclusions, and kick it back over to Leah.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to go back one. So we do the sum of the payroll costs. We take away the excluded payroll costs, and so you have your total payroll costs. Multiply it by 2.5, and that's the amount of loan that you can apply for. And, you know, since this is a calculation based on payroll costs, you should anticipate when you go and apply for this loan that you're going to bring evidence of what you use to calculate these costs, so your tax and your payroll records. And then the next step of the program, so you go and you apply, you get your 2.5 times. One of the reasons you're doing this is because, you know, what we've seen in the media and is that this is, in essence, free money. And it's free money because, or it has the potential to be free money, because it can be forgiven in the future by the SBA. And so you take the 2.5 times, which is about 11 weeks of salary that you can get, or payroll costs, and then you determine, and then you spend that money over the 8-week period after you get the loan. And over that 8-week period, you determine, based on what you spend, what the eligible amount that can be forgiven is. So how do we determine this eligible amount? So it is payroll. That really is the intent of the Paycheck Protection Program, is keeping people employed. So no less than 75% of the amount that can be forgiven is based on payroll costs. And you use the same calculation as you did at the beginning to see how you qualify for the loan. But, you know, it's 8 weeks covered versus 11 weeks in the calculation. So there's about 25% extra that you have on hand as a business as cash. And you can use that 25% and still get it forgiven for other things. So among those other things is interest on a mortgage that your business owns, rent on your leasing agreement, utility payments. So in essence, we want to keep businesses in their place of location with their employee base still in place So we're paying the leases, we're paying the utility payments, paying interest on mortgages. The caveat for this 25% is that it only pays for items where you had contracts for them as of February 15th, 2020. And so there is, you know, you're not going and getting a new lease. You're not, you know, changing the internet service for your business. So whatever it is, and expecting a reimbursement of that new cost that you're getting. The idea is to stay in place exactly as things were as of February 15th and cover costs going forward that would be incurred. But, you know, with everything, there is a bit of a catch. And, you know, for how much will be forgiven can be reduced. So let's see if Danielle, would you mind to talk about the reduction of forgiveness?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no problem. So here, because Congress wanted to encourage small businesses to keep employees employed and not lower their pay if not necessary, it said that, look, we'll have the lenders forgive this loan for the 8-week period, but any amount that would be forgiven is going to be reduced by two categories. One is if you've reduced the number of employees, so your payroll costs have effectively have decreased, and so Congress says it's fair to reduce the forgiven amount in that regard. And then if you've also reduced the salary of your existing employees, now caveat here is got to be anyone who was getting paid less than $100,000 in 2019. And there, it's sort of like a sliding scale, but the amount of forgiven amount is reduced by the reduction in wages that's greater than 25%. So it's not an easy calculation to figure out how much could be reduced, but the whole idea of the stimulus package is keep people hired, keep them at their 2019 wages, and you'll get this loan forgiven for if you meet all these criteria. So let's say you, at the end of the year, everything was fine, and then in February, you started having economic issues and you had to lay off some people. Here, Congress thought of this and said, look, for reductions in employment or wages that you did between February 15 and April 26, these will not reduce the amount of loan that's forgiven. If you rehire the people you've laid off by June 30th, or if you had reduced their salary, you bring it back to the 2019 levels for anybody who was getting paid less than $100,000. So how do you request for forgiveness? You go to the lender who gave you the loan, where you applied for the loan, got the loan, to check with them. You will need to – they could request and ask you to provide documents showing that the number of full-time employees you have and how much you've paid them, as well as what payments you've made on your lease or eligible mortgage or utility payments. And then you also have to certify the documents you're providing are true and that you did use that amount to keep employees employed and pay your rent or utility payments. And then the lenders will let you know if the loan amount that that's qualified for forgiveness has been forgiven within 60 days. The SBA is going to give us more guidance on this, so more to come on that. But for the time being, this is what we know about it.
Yeah. Thank you, Danielle. And I know I saw a few questions come in on this topic. Just to keep on track for timing, we're going to move forward, but we'll answer the questions at the end if we have time, and if we don't, we'll send out responses to the questions via email. So some of the details I mentioned earlier, starting today, small businesses can apply for Paycheck Protection Program loans. So it's small businesses and sole proprietorships as of today, and then as of next Friday, independent contractors and self-employed individuals can apply. So you can apply starting on that day and through June 30th. However, the Small Business Administration has said that you should apply as soon as possible because there today is $349 billion for this program. And depending on which politician you listen to, depends on what estimates they think are the damage to U.S. small businesses, but everybody seems to think that it's much more than $349 billion. So loans are on a first-come, first-served basis, so you should apply as soon as possible. It may be the case that the government will increase the amount that can be applied for, but I wouldn't rely on that. I would just get to your SBA lender as soon as you can to submit your application. You can apply with any SBA lender. We put a link in here so you can find the lenders. That being said, given that today's day one, you can actually just Google SBA lender and put in your region and pretty quickly find places that you can go. And then other non-SBA lenders, FDIC insured banks, credit unions, will also be participating. The government doesn't think that there's enough volume of employees and assistance available at just the SBA lenders to service this program and get all the loans out by June 30th, so they're opening it up to most financial institutions in the U.S. That being said, those non-SBA lenders don't have a date where they need to be onboarded, and they have an application that they have to have submitted. So they'll be rolling on over time. And if your bank is not an SBA lender, you can check with them on what their timeline is, or you can go over to a bank that is an SBA lender, in particularly one where you or a board member or important shareholder have a relationship that can get you to a relationship manager there. And then Danielle had talked about the forgiveness of the loan, but, it is a loan, so there is a possibility that not all of the loan will be forgiven. And there's, a distinct possibility that as a small business owner, you're taking the loan and actually expecting that not all of your uses of the loan will meet the forgiveness test, and you're just, accessing the capital today. And so for the loans that are not forgiven, there will be a 1% interest rate, and it'll be a 2-year term from the date of funding of the loan. And the first payment won't be due for 6 months. So if you get the loan today, 6 months from today, you'll start your payment scheduling, and the payments will go over the next 18 months. If your business comes back, if you have ability to prepay, there is no penalty for paying earlier than that 2-year period. There is an app. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, there is an application online that's available. The SBA tried to keep it short and sweet. It's pretty short, I think, but, you got to go through every question, make sure that you're answering correctly. And then they also want to know about any affiliates or any owners of your business that have 20% or more So you do have to provide that information. And they do accept signatures.
Yeah, and
go ahead, Leah.
Yeah, I just want to say just a quick note on the application. Make sure you're filling it out correctly. There's a little bit of a trick if you read the instructions. Some of the boxes have to be initialed and some of them have to be checked. So read the instructions and follow the instructions just to make sure that you're doing everything the correct way when you're submitting the loan. For the owners of more than 20% of your business, they have to respond to three of the questions on that page, and they can electronically respond. Or on an e-signature basis respond. But just making sure you're prepared and understand everybody who needs to make the certifications or answer questions and that you're doing things in the right manner.
Yeah. And then you do have to make certain certifications or when you sign, you're making new certifications that you've been in operation on February 15. You had employees that you paid salaries for. And because of what's going on in the economy, this loan is necessary for you. And you're going to be using the loan to retain your employees and pay their payroll and your mortgage and utility payments and lease payments, et cetera. And that you have documentation verifying your employees, your full-time employees that are on payroll. and that you haven't received another loan under this particular program. And the information providing is true and accurate, and that then you have to acknowledge that the lender will confirm your eligibility.
Sorry for moving you around, Danielle.
No worries. So that's it. I'm looking at the time, so I'm trying to move forward. Joe?
Yep.
I think.
Yep, this is me. And, you know, as part of attempting to alleviate some of the pain over these next 2 months, the CARE Act and FFCRA has provided these either retention credits or payroll tax deferral mechanisms. And you can hear more about these in detail at noon today. Our benefits team has a webinar that's taking place then. But for purposes of just the PPP loans issue, I think it's an important issue, and I'm going to skip going into detail with this. I think most of the key information is on here regarding the employee retention tax credit. However, if you apply for an employee retention tax credit by filing your form, your payroll tax form 941, or you're trying to receive an advance payment of employee credits on form 7200, the IRS said just this week you can do that on form 7200. Please keep in mind that interferes with the PPP process. You can't do both. And so if you seek an employee retention credit and right now you don't think you need a PPP, but in a month or so you decide that you need a PPP, you're probably going to have to recap some of that retention credit that you receive. So if you're applying today for a PPP loan, you're not going to be eligible for an an employee retention credit. And that's fine, because the PPP loan affords you far more benefit than the employee the retention tax credit. So, our recommendation is for you to go down that path of applying for the PPP loan, even though you won't be able to receive the retention credit. One last thing on the tax provision is that any amount forgiven under the PPP loans will not constitute income under IRC sections 108 and 61. That is clear in the CARES Act 1106I. So any debt forgiveness under the PPP will not constitute income. So sorry to rush you through that, but I did want to get those 2 points in there. And now I'll kick it back to Leah.
Oh, thank you. So just moving on, there was a second type of loan that you can qualify for, and that's called an economic injury disaster loan. This is the program that existed prior to COVID-19, so it's not a new program, but there has been some new additions to this program. It is also for small business, for small businesses, so less than 500 employees. So all of those standards that we talked about and the affiliation rules apply here too. You can borrow up to $2 million under this program, and you can get a loan advance of up to $10,000. And this loan advance, you can get whether or not you actually get certified as a borrower. And if you receive this loan advance, which you're supposed to be able to get within 3 days, this $10,000 will actually be deducted from your forgiveness amount under the PPP loan. So if you do the EIDL, you can go online today to the SBA website and submit an application for the EIDL if you so choose, and you can, you know, say that you need an emergency loan advance. And if you do that, you can't and get the money, and I want to stress it's up to $10,000. So it's not that everybody's getting a $10,000 check. That will be offset for your forgiveness amount. Also notably, EIDL loans of greater than $200,000 must be guaranteed, and my apologies for the typo, by owners having more than 20% ownership in that borrower. You can use the loan proceeds for working capital. You cannot use them for refinancing debt, expanding your facilities, moving your business, paying dividends or bonuses. And there is not a lot of guidance on how to figure out how much you need under the EIDL program. And, you know, what I've heard is that the SBA right now is overwhelmed with applications. So there's a little bit of a line, and they're supposed to be hiring 3,000 people to help administer the new programs. So they're getting up to speed at the same time. We're all reading the news and reading the guidance that's coming out. For the EIDL program, if you get a loan, the maturity date can be up to 30 years. So think of it more like a mortgage than that two-year loan under the payroll processing. The interest rate is 3.75% for businesses and 2.75% for nonprofits. Payments for EIDL loans because of coronavirus are deferred for up to 1 year. And I just want to note that under the PPP, they're deferred for 6 months. The original guidance had said it could be up to 1 year, and they said 6 months was enough. So we don't have the guidance yet for if that's 1 year or if it's going to be a shorter period of time. And, you know, I've covered a few of the other things. You can really put coronavirus SBA into Google and get to the link for applying for the loan, if you so choose. You know, and with that, I'm going to, you know, thank my colleagues for joining us. And then I guess I'll ask Danielle and Joe if you have any closing words or takeaways that you want people to, you know, remember as they're trying to navigate through these loan programs or this time.
Yeah, Danielle, sure. I'm, you know, the tax person on the call. I would just, you know, if you think the PPP process is too onerous, there are other tools out there available, such as the payroll deferral or the employee retention tax credit. So keep that in mind as you move through this process, and don't get too frustrated with it. Feel free to reach out to us with any questions you may have. Danielle?
Yes, thanks, Joe. I just want to say that, look, we're all going through this. If you find that something is confusing or it's not clear, don't be surprised. We're also finding it not clear, but we'll get through this. And Leah is our star, so if you have any questions or need any help, she's the right person to reach out to, and then she can also coordinate with others at our firm if you need help. We'll try to help you as much as we can, and if we have more guidance or if we get more explanations, we'll provide that on our hub, on the coronavirus hub that we have, which you can also sign up for and get regular updates so that you know whenever something new is uploaded on there.
Yeah, and thanks for both of you for joining and giving us your expertise. I wanted to say one thing that I didn't realize was not on the slides, on the EIDL versus payroll protection or paycheck protection loan. If you want to submit for both, you should do the EIDL first and then the payroll protection second, because the receipt of a payroll protection loan will disqualify you for receipt of an EIDL loan, but it does not work the other way around. So it really is a timing game. We don't know how long the funds will last under the payroll protection loan. We know the applications should be able to be submitted today. Oftentimes we see when the government says that kind of thing, there's like one bank that takes applications, or they take it at 4 o'clock. So I don't know. I'm not standing at a bank, but my guess is that some applications will be submitted today, but there won't be a line out the door of people getting their applications in. And next week it's going to ramp up, and it's going to be a lot of stress on the system for our banks. So, I encourage everybody to be as patient as they can with everybody, including us. As we might not have an answer to your question right away, but we'll do everything we can to research it or watch out as new legislation comes down to make sure we can answer your questions and give you the best advice. So following up on this, I saw a lot of questions being submitted, and I thank you very much for your questions. So we will respond to the questions over email.